Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
This is Sam Edwards, proud sponsor of Heritage Radio Network, SurreyFarms.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every week at about 11, today at 11:05, due to something we'll probably talk about later, we bring you a conversation about taste, one of the most important senses, I believe. And today we're going to be talking about it with two people who I've spent a lot of time talking about taste with over the years. We're welcoming to Bushwick Andrew Carmelini and Gwen Hyman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Awesome.
We are finally here after a failed L train and an impossibility of finding a cab in New York City when a train is down, and commandeering a streetcar, or what do you call those things?
A gypsy cab,
right.
A streetcar.
Soon to be legal.
Where are we?
In Toronto, where Gwen and I grew up. Anyway, and we are in Bushwick. And Andrew, as those of you listening probably know, is the chef and co-owner of two great beloved restaurants here in New York and one now in Miami, The Dutch and Locanda Verde. And he and Gwen have written two wonderful cookbooks together. And the most recent book, American Flavor, is actually what I want to talk about today, because I think this concept of what American flavor is one of the most important and ongoing conversations anyone really ever has here in America. So let me just put it out there, guys. What is American Flavor?
American Flavor is a book that kind of came to be when I was thinking about opening up an American restaurant. Mm-hmm. And it's always a complicated issue with chefs and people who care about food and people who write about food, is what is American cuisine? And it's a very complicated issue,
yes,
if there is even one. And this was just my kind of collection of stories and my travels and the way I grew up in food, which is kind of my story of American cuisine and American cooking, which could be completely different from someone else's. But it's this whole collection is what American Flavor is. Which is my American food story over the years,
which
is a little bit of everything. It's the foods that I grew up with in Ohio. It's lots of traveling with my family around the country. It's dishes that people I've worked with over the years have cooked. It's what my grandmother cooked. It's what your grandmother cooked. And it's kind of a collection of all of that.
Do you mean that those things with cornflakes rolled in sweet potato dumplings are in this book? That's what my grandmother cooked.
I'm not even going to tell you what my grandmother cooked.
I know what she cooked. I was there. So, Gwen, you're the wordsmith. What's the difference? But why, if this were called American cuisine instead of American flavor, what's the difference there? And
well, it's interesting. I mean, to me, cuisine is a word that is really actually much more sort of highfalutin. And when Andrew talks about cuisine, he's also talking about the professional kitchen, I think. And one of the things that Andrew takes up in his restaurants and that was really important to us in the book is that we sort of, historically, we sort of thought of American cuisine as not really American. We thought about it as French cuisine. And American cooking was what you did at home or what you ate at the diner. And so there was a high-low split. And I think that, you know, we all know over the last decade that split has really disappeared. And American flavor is really about how we live in food, I think. How we understand ourselves through food, how we make culture through what we cook and what we eat and where we eat. And it really breaks down those differences between high and low in some pretty fundamental ways.
Interesting. Well, before we carry on this conversation, let me remind people at home that if you're listening to us on live, you can call us with a question at area code 718-497-2128, or you can write us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.com. And if you're listening to a podcast, why don't you tweet us a question at Taste Matters HRN, and we'll be sure to answer you, if not on the air right now, but certainly sometime in the future. Okay, so high-low. Let's talk about the high-low of food. Andrew, you have worked in some very high places, and even though your low places are not very low, you know, I know there are some people out there who think if only you were cooking in a 3-star Michelin restaurant, all the world would be well. Talk about high-low.
You know, I've always been more inspired by kind of what the grandmothers were cooking than the great chefs. I always felt that that was I feel that way even more so now than I did before. I guess I've always been looking for the soul of cooking and the soul of, like, my favorite experiences eating have always been, you know, in a more casual environment, many times not even in a restaurant. It's, you know, at someone's home or cooking with friends or just that combination of, you know, the people that you're eating with and the great food that you're eating with, so I've been more, I've been always inspired by that to try to capture that kind of like that, that soulfulness.
Do you think something's changed? Do you think that that soul has been lost a little bit over the generations in fancy restaurants?
No, actually, I think it's reverting back to trying to capture. We have both ends of the spectrum. You have the, I guess, the end of quote-unquote molecular gastronomy and the beginning of the naturalist movement, which I would call the Noma-inspired movement, and which is great. And then you have kind of the return to that with a bunch of different kind of restaurants all over the world trying to capture, I guess, roots cooking, if you would, in a certain way. And so I think it's both things are happening. It's kind of polarizing that way.
So you've just mentioned two things, two experiences that I know you just had almost back to back. One is a molecular meal with Nathan Myhrvold in the laboratory that we've all heard so much about and seen the gorgeous heavy pictures in that $7,000 book that he produced called Modernist Cuisine. And you've also just been to Lummi Island to the Willows, which is sort of an American interpretation of this naturalist movement. Gwen, Juxtapose two things for me.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the modernist dinner that we had at Nathan Myhrvold's was very interesting. And it was interesting to see an engineer come to food because what engineers do is solve problems. And
we'll remind people at home that Nathan Myhrvold was a Microsoft programmer engineer when...
Yeah, he's a long-time certified genius. Right. Studied with Stephen Hawking.
Right.
Founded part of Microsoft's programs. He's a Silicon Valley.
Okay. And then became obsessed with food, created this giant project, won a James Beard Cookbook of the Year award just a few weeks ago.
Mm. Would you like to hear my impression?
Yes, sure I think everyone would.
Yeah.
I'd like to cook the steak with a laser beam.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think that sort of encapsulates a lot of that experience. You know, there was a lot of cool stuff going on.
Of course.
There was a lot of really interesting approaches to food as science.
Right.
But, you know, Lummi Island was, Andrew used the word soul before, and, you know, our dinner at the Willows Inn was... The word that I always think of is my grandmother's word, which is Hamish. It was very home-like. It was warm and lovely. And it was really, you know, the cooks were serving at table. Mm-hmm. So there was really no separation between kitchen and dining room. Mm-hmm. And the kitchen is open and at the end of the dining room. The food was very, very, very local, from the farm up the hill, from the water that you can see outside the windows. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the preparations were... deceptively simple. And it was all about flavor, and it was all about the interaction between chef and diner. You could see that it was really about I am going to feed you and you know, give you
pleasure. It felt like eating in someone's house, even though they were doing it's definitely not modernist, and there was definitely some, you know, techniques going on, there was maybe one or two chemicals, if you will, but it was very natural and very. I really, really, really enjoyed it. And Nathan's the lab was interesting. My favorite stuff there was how he's kind of tried to extract maximum flavor in a scientific way, and that was successful. And like, there was a couple techniques that were very successful. I think some that were, I don't know, more kind of fetishizing the technique more than about kind of like trying to highlight the best flavor, but
things you could use, perhaps.
Yeah, things you definitely can use.
I mean, people mock molecular gastronomy now because it's the thing to mock now, but you walk into kitchens. I was just at Aterra, and there's a gastrovac there, even though it's not on the menu that they've been using a gastrovac to do. I don't even know what he's doing with it. So,
well, that's what I think. You know, there was definitely a period of time where the molecular movement was about over fetishizing the ingredient, and, you know, going to a restaurant and getting, instead of getting presented a whole roast chicken, beautiful roast chicken, you were was happening some places, you were getting presented a bag with a
I will never forget that experience in Floating in Water. I can even say where. I will never forget that experience in my life. But per se, I just started laughing. They actually came with a bag chicken underwater.
Yeah, so it's I think it's, you know, this, it was a kind of
to
a,
the table. It was just, I still can't believe it.
It's interesting, like, how fast, you know, that the whole thing kind of has happened, and where, you know, where we are now with it, and it'll probably evolve even more, which is great.
Yeah, it makes me think of, you know, the work that Laurent Gras was doing at L2O, mm-hmm. where there was that real sort of integration of molecular gastronomy and traditional approaches. And he did the opposite. So mm-hmm. you wouldn't know that there were chemicals going on unless you went into the kitchen. And yet the food was so delicious because what he was doing was using all of those techniques to make the best version of a more traditional thing that you can possibly imagine.
Interesting.
Well, but, I mean, long before Ferran was consulting with chemists, if you ate at El Bulli, there were no chemicals involved. It was just, if you see, even in the first book, there's not a xanthan gum to be found or hydrocolloid to be found in the first book. It was really just high Catalanian cuisine, Catalan cuisine.
So something just dawned on me, Gwen. Your other life, maybe some might say your real life, although we won't use that distinction. Your academic life is as a Victorianist, and there's this return to this nature in food that I wonder if you have any perspective on. That seems to me has this fetishization of, that's such a hard word to say on the radio, I see a pond somewhere and someone thinking about nature and writing sonnets in the kitchen.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because certainly through the 19th century in both England and America, there was this reaction to industrialism that was nostalgic, that was going back to nature. I mean, it really starts at the end of the 18th century, and it comes and goes through the century. And It certainly had to do with cuisine as well, and the way that it was talked about was in terms of national cuisines. So French cooking, you know, we know that in the 19th century, this is when the modern restaurant developed in France, and so on and so forth. And in Britain, there were two reactions. One reaction is, this is the coolest thing we have ever seen ever, and everybody needs a French chef. And it was sort of like, look what I can do with my laser beam. and the other reaction was a very, let's go back to basics. Food is affiliated with morality. And that morality is nationalized and it is regionalized sort of approach. And I think that there are a lot of similarities that, you know, the further away that we get from work of the hand, the more we long for work of the hand. The more we spend our days online, the more we want a chicken in the backyard in Brooklyn. Right?
Right, of course. Well, I laugh. The whole foraging thing that's happening right now, which, you know, is great. I love forage things. But it just makes me think of growing up in Toronto, where the old ladies in black dresses would be on the sides of the roads picking dandelions, not because it was cool, but because there was food out there and you could eat it and make it into things that you couldn't even buy in the store then. So are some contrasting waves of
I remember going in the when I was at when I was at Cafe Bleu, I started to do these foraged tasting menus.
Really?
And so this is 1999, 2000, and no one wanted it. I was bringing, and we would do them for some special customers, and we'd bring in cattails and some spruce tops and some things that, you know, we had a guy in Canada and a guy in Vermont that we could get these things for. And we even had we had hunters that would bring us doves and moose and all this amazing stuff, and it really freaked people out. It really freaked my customers out, and I got into it for a little bit, and I remember going on a couple. I befriended this woman from the Natural History Museum that gave tours, and I remember going with her to Central Park to pick ginkgo nuts one day, and there was two other people on the tour. And I can imagine if that tour was happening now, how many people would be and what the demographic would be on Amazing. That tour.
So we're going to imagine that over a short break, and we'll be right back talking about Taste Matters.
When it's real, they get scared. Got a slave for the welfare. Ain't no food, clothes, or healthcare. I'm down for guerrilla warfare. All my niggas put your guns in the air. If you really don't care, skunk in the air. Make a nigga wanna buck in the air. From a bunker locked up in the jump in the air. Shit is real out here. Don't believe these videos. This fake ass industry. Gotta pay to get a song on the radio. Really though, DP's gonna let you know. It's just a game of pimps and hoes. And it's all about who you know. Not who we are or how we grow. I rap about what I know, what I go through, what I've been through. Not just for no dope. Even though the rent due, what I'm into ain't for no dope or just for fame. Everything must change, nothing remains the same. Sick of the same old thing is bigger than blame, blame.
If I feel it, I feel it. If I don't, I don't. If it ain't really real, then I probably.
The following program was sponsored by S. Wallace Edwards and Sons. Summertime is not the only time when barbecue is welcome. At S. Wallace Edwards and Sons, Sam Edwards has been working his magic on ribs, briskets, pit-cooked pulled pork, and much, much more. Add a few of their sides, and the party is complete. Entertaining has never been so easy. To order, go to virginiatraditions.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking about American flavor with Andrew Carmelini and Gwen Hyman, co-authors of a great book on American flavor, actually, and also partners in a journey of food. One of the things that I thought was really interesting about the book when I was revisiting it last night, and it just, it all just makes me hungry in a way that a lot of books don't. Maybe it is this idea of soulfulness, but you want to get in the kitchen and try it. The recipes seem really, they seem interesting and familiar at the same time.
My first book, Urban Italian and American Flavor, the second book, I really wanted people to cook for them.
Mm-hmm.
And even the way the book falls when you open it. So when you open it, you don't have to put, like...
Oh, really?
You know, you don't have to crease it so it stays open.
Or put the coffee grinder on it so the pages
really
don't turn.
Really tried to think about, all those little details. Like, it would be awesome if I saw this book in 3 years and there were, like, tomato sauce stains on it and, like, some spilled red wine. And that was kind of how... I wanted people to cook from it as well. It'd be a beautiful book, and let it be, the words be beautiful. I wanted the end result to be awesome.
You do 25 years into your career, you do still love to cook, don't you?
Yeah, a lot. Yeah, a lot. I do.
You're in the kitchen a lot. Well, not a lot of people can't wait to get out in some ways.
Yeah, no, I really, I always really, really like the cooking part. With three restaurants, inevitably, there's a little bit less of that going on,
right?
Which I'm still trying to wrap my head around.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because the third is a new Dutch in Miami, not so new anymore, mm-hmm. but in Miami, mm-hmm. the first that isn't walkable between the two places.
Right.
What has that experience been like?
My grandfather, my dad is from Miami. A lot of people are like, why the hell did you open up in Miami? It doesn't seem like part of you at all.
Right.
And I'm like, well, actually, my family's from Miami. My grandfather was an Italian guy who had a club in Miami Beach in the 50s, and he was a general manager at a hotel there for like 20 years.
Wow.
And so, they're like old school Miami people. So I always... went to Miami a lot when I was a kid, and I love Miami. So it just seemed kind of a natural first place to do something.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely weird to have a restaurant. I don't know how these other guys do it. They have restaurants all over the world. I tried one in Miami. I'm not 100% sure I'm going to like run off to Singapore to open up two restaurants. Not my cup of tea, maybe, but...
And let's talk a little bit about the... obviously, there's the logistics challenge of running a business and running a kitchen and mm-hmm. managing people in two very different places. But what have you found different, on this theme of American flavor? What's been different about the reception of the food, or how you cook, or how people eat, or how they engage with a restaurant? I'm just curious.
The first thing I noticed in Miami is how many more doggy bags get used.
Really? Do you have an early bird special?
No. There's no early bird. There's zero early bird. We are packed at midnight, and at 7, there's nobody there. It's
my people's Miami, which started at 4:30 up in Boca.
this is late night party town Miami, which is cool. It's like I don't know. It's like having a restaurant in Madrid.
Wow. And you do think that everyone thinks New York is the city that never sleeps, but then you go to Madrid or Miami and you're like, actually, we can go to bed at a reasonable hour.
New York is become a much tamer place. It's a bedroom community. people live here. They're having families.
So we have a Twitter question, not exactly related to what we're talking about, but since we got one, we're going to ask it from, I don't know if it's DJ Ree. I don't know that many people have to pronounce Twitter handles aloud. They're not really meant for that. But he wants to know, do you have a favorite knife brand? Knives, obviously, for chefs have become the thing that we're supposed to believe is the most important tool for you. First of all, do you believe that? Is the knife, do you bring your knives everywhere? Do they never travel? Do they never get packed under, checked under the airplane?
I check them in my luggage. Okay. I had an experience at Newark Airport where I forgot to pack one of my knives on a charity trip to Hawaii in the luggage. I had it in my carry-on, and it was like a $700 knife.
There it went with the bottles of water and the oranges.
Yeah, and there was actually the guy at the TSA guy actually looked me in the eye and said, you could probably find it on eBay in a couple months.
Oh, nice. Good.
So, you know, I have I've toned down my knife my knife collection over the years, and I have a couple knives. Before, I had all different kind of Japanese knives and, you know, knives I bought in France. And, you know, I had a French cleaver and a Chinese cleaver. And it was just ridiculous. Now I just have a small little Japanese knife bag that has probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 knives inside. And there's everything from, you know, just a Henkel boning knife, which is the best. You know, the best thing out there for cutting meat. And I have Misono Japanese knives. I have 2 of those. I love those because they're inox, so you don't have to polish them, and they're very, very user-friendly, even though they're very, very sharp. I have 1 Bob Kramer knife out in Seattle, American guy that makes knives. His are great. And, you know, just I have a Victoria Knox serrated knife, which is... So you got to have one of those.
You've seen in every kitchen anyone's ever been in.
Yeah, you have to have one of those. They're very, but I've toned it down a lot. And the Chinese cleaver. I've gotten rid of my French butcher knife, and I use the Chinese cleaver. I can break down a baby pig or a baby lamb in like 8 minutes with a Chinese cleaver.
Cool. Okay, so there you go, Dr. Ree, or DJ Ree.
DJ Ree,
sorry. Let's get back to this concept of working together on a book, since part of this job as the words person, Gwen, is to try to figure out what he does and tell it and create a narrative around it in some ways. And in the matter of this book, there's many, many narratives, little beautiful stories that lead up to almost every recipe. What's that like, both as the co-writer but also as the partner?
I think it's the true test of your relationship.
Sure.
You know, well, we figured out how to do this when we wrote Urban Italian. Mm-hmm. And we wrote Urban Italian in our extremely tiny Stuytown kitchen. I literally sat on the windowsill because it was the only surface. And we went through 2 computers because of iced coffee mishaps. There was, you know, there's a lot of... I think for any writer working with a chef, part of the difficulty is that a great chef cooks by feel. Mm-hmm. So Andrew puts things together, and when I say how long or how much, his natural response is as much as you need, as long as it takes.
Right.
So getting him to, what's that word I'm looking for, measure, was complicated. And there was a lot of sort of learning, for both of us, learning how to be telling the story of what he's cooking. What actually made it easier is the fact that I don't cook, and I really don't.
Well, you cook now.
I
after 2 books, you've
I have learned a lot. But I am also, in some ways, you know,
The novice you're writing for.
Exactly. Exactly. So I want to know what it should look like, what it should smell like, what it should feel like. Because if you shorthand it, I don't get it.
Which some people have commented and criticized that sometimes the recipes are over-explanatory.
Well, thank you so much.
But I think it's ridiculous. But we always said from the beginning, we were writing Urban Italian or writing American flavors, that, you know, it's a chef kind of driven book and it's all these stories and all this narrative, but we really wanted anyone to be able to cook these recipes, even though some of them are more complicated or have a lot of ingredients that you might not have in your pantry so that was really, I don't know, we stuck to our guns, and if we do a third one, it'll be the same.
I think it's great. I think cookbooks and food people have ostracized a lot of people who are intimidated by the lack of information. The recipes are almost written in jargon in some ways, and I know that it can be daunting to see a lot of words on the page, but actually if they're telling you what to do, the more the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, we really, you know, I've cooked from chef cookbooks where I start out really enthusiastic and very excited about what I'm going to make, and halfway through it just falls apart because I don't understand. And if you haven't made the dish before and you haven't had the dish, then how do you know what it's supposed to be like when you get to the end? It's a real conundrum.
Right. Which is an interesting, I mean, it's interesting culturally when we're here talking about this idea of American food and American flavor, because, you know, the idea of exact measurements and specific details for recipes is sort of an American idea. And in Italy, if you're writing an Italian cookbook, and there's only 11 dishes anyway in all of Italy, but I'm sorry, I know there are more, but everyone knows what their cooking is supposed to be like, more or less. When you're done, you don't have to be as specific. Unless you're writing a Vietnamese book for an Italian audience. And here we just assume everyone knows nothing. It's all new. And
it's true. I mean, it's very much the American experience, right? I mean, if you're cooking somebody's grandmother's food, that cooking is probably not the same as your grandmother's food, right? And one way that Andrew has talked about this book is that it's not just an American book, a book about American flavor, but it's really a book about New York flavor. Mm. And in that sense, it's extremely cosmopolitan, right? I mean, I think the way we sort of understand flavor in the book is not just going to the source and the authentic thing wherever we find it in America, but how we then bring that back to a New York kitchen and understand it through sort of this urban sensibility.
Right. Yeah. A pastiche almost of flavor.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And it's not melting pot, but it is stuff from all over. And there's no way that anybody has... The average home cook has a sense of all of those things as sort of mastery.
Right.
Interesting. I'm still going back to the point where Mitch just said that Italian cuisine just has 11 dishes.
Let me change that. Are we
getting any tweets about that?
One dish, but a lot of different ingredients that you can put in it. Interesting. So, dear. I like those dishes. Don't get me wrong.
No,
they're the best.
I'm with you. You know, there's chicken Toscano and...
and eggplant parm sandwich heroes, right? Authentic Italian food. This idea of a pastiche is sort of... You're seeing it crop up in restaurants. Like we just ate at Parm when it was Chinese night, which is a restaurant down in the Lower East Side that... Rich Teresi, a former chef of yours, colleague, and Mario Carbone, who have an Italian, quote-unquote, Italian-American restaurant, but Sunday's Chinese because of the neighborhood. And even at the far other end of the spectrum, 11 Madison is trying to incorporate all of these New York-y things. You know, there's cream cheese, and black and white cookies come at the beginning, and they're truffles, and they come at the end, and they're cookies, and all that kind of stuff. Is there a movement here? Are we going to have to name this whole thing?
It's the post-naturalist movement. It's the micro neighborhood movement.
Right. We say sitting here in Roberto's, which is a micro neighborhood in and of itself, I think.
Definitely.
Yeah. What's next for you guys? You mentioned a third book. Is there one coming? Is there another restaurant? No. No.
There's no plans for a new book. I think we're taking this summer off since the summer before we just worked on the book the whole time. Restaurants in New York City, if the real estate presents itself, then sure, we'd love to do another restaurant. Right. But it kind of real estate drives everything.
Real estate drives everything.
I'd love to cook French again one day.
Yeah.
I'd love to do another Italian restaurant.
Oh, really? What would be different about another Italian restaurant? What would you want to do?
I think I'd like to do something a little bit more high end than Lakonda. Yeah. A little bit more, a little smaller, a little bit more focused. And I have another kind of Italian restaurant thing that's I still haven't defined yet that I want to do also. But I'd love to cook French food again one day.
Neat. I think we might love you to do that too. A few critics I know would actually haven't eaten since you stopped.
But more not a high end ideal of French cooking. Yeah. I think it would be more of a country ideal or more of a looking at France as with Spanish influence and Italian influence like you find in the Southwest and in the Southeast, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, the France of Burgundy and Lyon and Paris that we know and love. Mm-hmm. I'd like to do that someday.
Well, we will look forward to that, and we'll look forward to the book that will inevitably come from that, from the two of you. It'll be urban French or French flavor.
French urban flavor.
Next week, speaking of urban flavors, we're going to be talking to Deborah First, who is one of the food editors of The Forward and has a great blog called The Jew and the Carrot. And we're going to be talking about other New York flavors, the Jewish influence and the sort of modern Jewish Israeli movement that's happening everywhere from pastrami sandwiches with fancy meat to Sephardic Jewish restaurants and Israeli bakeries right next to my barber on 9th Street. Anyway, look forward to talking about that. Remember that if you're listening to the podcast and you want to get in touch with us, you can tweet or follow us at Taste Matters HRN. We'll be here next week at 11 o'clock, right at 11 o'clock, assuming that the subway works. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.